Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Glad to be together. We're going to get kicked off. We are in the second of our series here. It's going to be a 6-week class calling it The E Word, talking about evangelism. We're beginning on the front end of this, looking at the history of evangelism in the church. And towards the end, we're going to land on more of a theological and practical discipleship lens of evangelism. And so last week we talked about evangelism from the perspective of the earliest church, really looking in the book of Acts pretty much exclusively. If you missed that and would like to catch up with that, I have made a firm commitment that all of our Sunday school classes moving forward are online. So you will find that class online on the church's website and only on the church's website. So that's where you'll find that if you want to watch it. Or listen to it, rather. I'm glad that you're here today. Today, we're going to, following a very Michael Gorecki kind of grid, we're going to try to cover 1,800 years in one day. So you can imagine how well I'm going to do at that. But the reality is, if we're going to push forward into the class, we had to keep a pretty quick pace. So we're going to be looking very broadly. I'm not going to be throwing a lot of names at you, though if you wanted to have a historical sort of read on this, I have a book that I can recommend that does a nice job of walking you through sort of the different phases of this. I really want us to just get to some of the high points and to see it from a very high level. So I first want to sort of make sure that we all get a sense for the importance of region in the evangelical work of the church after the book of Acts. What you need to know is that in AD 70, the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed by Rome. Jerusalem is a very, very violent and volatile place in the first century. It is a full of different forms of political protest and actual military uprisings. In fact, the New Testament is colored by that reality, and we often miss it in our reading, that Jerusalem was considered a place by the Roman overseers as a place that needed to be tamped down. It needed to be a place highly secured, because if it wasn't, people would lose their heads and they would go and they would essentially try to have armed uprisings. And in AD 70, Rome had finally reached the end of its line. It had decided, following several substantial war riots and then attempted coups, they said, we're done. And so they went in and they completely destroyed the temple. They just leveled it. And in fact, the damage that they did remains to this day. You have the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, and that is at the hands of the Romans. That's their work. And what happens is it completely devastates the institutional Jewish church. So you want to think the Sadducees and the teachers of the law, if you were with us in the book of Luke study that we were doing online, those are the people that get named once Jesus gets to Jerusalem. It switches, it no longer talks about Pharisees. Luke switches into Sadducees or teachers of the law. These are the very notable, very wealthy, very aristocratic, sort of old school religious leadership of Israel. They are essentially destroyed in AD 70 because their entire life revolved around the temple. All of their life revolved around the idea of the sacrifices happening in the temple. You remember Jesus when his parents brought him to be not baptized, to be dedicated. They had to buy these birds, right? And there's these animals of sacrifice. Jesus turns over the table in the temple. It's a highly profitable economic center in Jerusalem. And so once it's destroyed, the center of that life disappears. So where does the Jewish tradition go? And the Christians who are worshiping with those Jews, they go into synagogues. And synagogues are not region-based. They're all throughout. They're in rural Israel. There's what we would call churches or congregations dotted throughout the landscape. Okay. Why am I spending so much time getting us kicked off when we have 1,800 years to cover? Is because this begins the outward thrust of the Christian movement regionally. You can now watch as the Apostle Paul and his missionary journeys and all of those other missionary journeys we don't have logged, but we know happened, that they begin to spread the gospel rapidly throughout the known world. In fact, there's reason to believe by the year 100, there's good reason to believe that Christians are already having congregations in as far away as Great Britain, or what we would call England, all the way over to India and China. So the gospel has spread radically. But, and this is where we're going to move forward and transition here very quickly, is that the center of the Christian faith you might know of as being in Jerusalem up to AD 70. But what happens when that city is utterly destroyed? Well, the center of the Christian faith moves south. So when it goes southwest, and it actually gets taken up in the middle of St. Augustine, and all of those sort of centered bishops were in Alexandria. So we, especially those of us in the West, we tend to forget that the earliest center of lasting Christian thought and leadership came from Africa, came from the northwest tip of Africa. And you might know of like the Great Library of Alexandria and these kinds of things. Alexandria is formed following, Alexander's great sort of military movement, right? He makes a city in his image in northwest Africa. It becomes one of the longer standing peace centers. Why does this matter? So some names that do matter, they're the greats of the Christian faith, are like St. Augustine. He lived and worked in Alexandria. And it's because of his writing that every Christian thinker following is essentially writing the theology that they do. You might not know this, but Luther and Calvin and the Catholic Pope and all of those people in the Reformation, the one person they all quoted when they were arguing with each other was Augustine. What mattered was, does Augustine agree with you, or does he agree with me? And so what ends up happening is the Christian faith begins to be centered in Northwest Africa, and that is where a great amount of formation happens of Christian leadership. They then go and begin to evangelize all the way down the African continent itself. Simultaneously, you might know Antioch and that entire region are an incredibly great center of Christian life as well. And so there you begin to have this growing sort of secondary church. We don't have a lot of time to talk about church history, but it is relevant. You have the Byzantinian church made. So you have that church existing today, two words, Eastern Orthodox, right? So the Roman church has had this whole long, what you might know as the Roman Catholic Church, right? We have one actually here in town. That church, through a very strange historical kind of lineage, gets connected all the way back to the earliest church. But it's not a perfectly connected lineage because of the way that history played out. The Eastern Orthodox Church has been functioning the exact same period of time, with their own leadership being traced all the way back to the disciples. Michael, why does this matter? Because the Eastern Orthodox are doing evangelism into the East all the way from the beginning of the faith. So it's only later that Rome becomes the center of Roman Catholicism. Once Alexandria itself is sacked, that theological religious power comes back. Okay, this sets up the middle part of history. We're essentially up to about 430 AD with Alexandria and with the library, with Augustine, all these people. Then we move into what historians would call the Middle Ages, or what used to be called the Dark Ages, but the academia decided it wasn't nice to say that they were dark. We're going to just call them medieval. So we're looking at from about 6th century to 15th century. Now, I'll be honest with you, if you look at it, it looks like a very strange period for evangelism, because the evangelism in this period looks significantly like European monks doing European conversion. And then when we think of Europe, I think we think of them as sort of a connected block. But I have to remind you, or conjure into your mind, a period in which Europe is a bunch of disconnected feudal lords, right? And many of these bandits or very loosely organized tribes. Okay. And so the Catholic Church at this time has priests who think to themselves, we need to begin a missionary effort to convert these pagans, is what they would have called them. So they send out monks all around the European continent to do this work. One monk in particular was chiefly known for his evangelistic effort. His name was Benedict. He started the Benedictine order. And if you've ever been to a monastery, it's likely it was Benedictine. Now there are many different houses within the Catholic Church, but the Benedictine order is one of the largest, and it's one of the most ancient. He sent monks and trained monks intentionally to go do this evangelistic effort all throughout Europe. Here's the catch. There was very little success in Central Europe. I wish I had time to pull up a map for you so we can all be looking at this. But Central Europe was a very, very difficult place because, number one, the geography was hard. There's several mountainous regions that was hard to get people into a place. And also, the leadership there was generally violent and generally not interested in peace. So the idea that they were going to be civilized, this is what the monks would have said, right? Civilized, that these pagans would be civilized. And ultimately, this was the big catch-up. They were not interested in being subject to the leader of the Catholic Church, who was and still is the Pope. The Pope was not just a theological figure, but a political figure, someone who could make claims about what you should and shouldn't do. And so the tribes in the middle of these pagan groups in the middle of Europe were uninterested in the Pope making decisions for them. So the Benedictines are still doing all of their work, and then they find extreme success. A group and a region who responded very, very generously to the proclamation of the gospel, and that was the people of Spain and Southwest Europe. And in this whole period, there's this flourishing and this growing of the Christian faith there. Some of the most ancient sanctuaries are found in regions, not just Italy, but Spain. And some of the reason for that is some of the early evangelistic success. That eventually slows down because the evangelism hits some of the natural walls. There's mountain ranges in northern Spain. So the gospel sort of finds a stopping point there through some of the Middle Ages. I promise, we're going to keep pushing on here. Bear with me, friends. So as history keeps going, right, we have centers in Spain, we have centers in Europe, the Eastern Orthodox Church is doing their thing. And now, actually, the African Church has begun some of its own work under its own title and leadership. And that will be a history that we're going to kind of leave there. They're doing their own thing. This then becomes a very, very interesting period in Christian history from about 1096 to 1291. It's fascinating. You all remember Y2K, right? This concern that the clock was going to flip and all the power generators are going to turn off and all the telecommunications can be done. Your bank account's going to be zeroed. There's this real fear with the turning of that millennia, right? We are in an interesting position of history that we can resonate with that. The year 1000 had its own kind of 2000 moment. They weren't worried about computers, clearly. But they believed, and it was regularly taught, that the 1,000-year mark was the return of Jesus, that was the end. And so throughout the Roman Catholic Church at that time, which we have to remember, that was the church, right? You say, I'm Presbyterian. They would say, what is that? Presbyterians don't exist. If you're Christian, you're Catholic, in the Latin world at least. And for them, this reached all throughout the region. These teachings were widely disseminated. So the year 1000 was a time of great fervent sort of revival in the church. There was a great amount of passion and energy related, and that extended to evangelism. The church just flung out missionaries as far as it could in the belief we've got to get people before the year 1000. But then history has a way of repeating itself. The world didn't shut down in the year 2000, and I think you can guess it also didn't in the year 1000. And so there was a great kind of depression that following the year 1000, which then culminated beginning in the year 1096, so just 100 years after, in the Crusades. We often don't think of this as being connected in the history of the church, but the Crusades was ultimately a kind of reverse evangelistic effort. Because around the year 1000, the what would be Muslim nations from the East are doing, the Huns weren't Muslim, but there were also several Muslim nations in the midst of this, were successfully launching military campaigns against the Roman Empire, which had now completely fallen. So while Rome is no longer a center of security and power, Byzantine still is. Constantinople still is. And so the Eastern Church has a period in which it is secure and growing and sending out missionaries, while Rome is retracting and losing geographic distance. So there comes a time where the Pope essentially makes an encyclical. Remember, he's not just a theological leader, he's a political leader. And he says, with this new fervency that's happening around year 1000, he says, if you want to be a person of faith and you have power, you should go reclaim the Holy Land. If you're a person who is capable of pushing back these non-religious people invading our lands, it is incumbent upon you to do so. So you have what is created, essentially entire armies of people who respond to this call to push back Muslim, what they see as Muslim advances. And ultimately, they do take Jerusalem. You say, this is a weird thing, Michael. They include the evangelism class. It doesn't seem like killing people is a form of evangelism. And I want to turn the conversation, because that's a very 21st century mentality. When we think of evangelism, we think of that, hey, let's sit down with someone. Let's have a conversation with them. Let me explain to you why you should change your mind on this. This is our 21st century mentality. When you believe that your faith was cultural, when you always said, well, I'm a Germanic Christian, right? Or when you said, I'm a Spanish Christian, or I'm an Eastern Orthodox, when you identified your faith with a specific tribal leadership or political identity, it was not a jump for them to say that I'm doing a good thing when I rid the world of people who aren't that thing. If they're unwilling to convert, then I need to do my part to stop that, which results in some of the greatest travesties done in the name of Christianity. The Crusades is not just warfare, in which horrible things happen in warfare across all time and places, but is actually the things that follow that, even within the Roman Church, in which people are brutalized and they're tortured and they're put and interrogated by the church itself, people within the church, monks, priests, church members, something like almost what you might imagine the Salem witch trials was happening within the Catholic Church in this time. So evangelism from that time in history forward bore this kind of cultural stain, because at the end of the day, it exposed that at that time, the church was firmly intertwined in its understanding that evangelism was a kind of cultural movement. That if someone was going to become a Christian, they had to give up their power, their political power, they had to submit to the Pope, and then ultimately they had to change their culture enough to be reflective of the Catholic faith. And if you couldn't do that, if you were unwilling to make those changes, then ultimately the effect was, then we're going to wage crusade against you. We're just going to get rid of you. This becomes a very dark kind of movement within the Christian church of around that year 1000. That then ultimately is going to move forward to something that you are very much more familiar with, I expect, and that is the Reformation. We're only looking about 500 years after the Crusades that the reformers begin to have conversations about what it looks like to return to Scripture, and as I said, to return to Augustine, to begin to rethink what this theology meant all along. And of course, if you know anything about Luther and Calvin, they had nothing good to say about the Pope. In fact, if you want to turn red, I encourage you to go look up, just Google Luther or Calvin insults about the Pope, and anything that you've seen on social media pales in comparison to the thing the reformers said about the Pope. Why? because they ultimately believed that the Pope needed to be stripped of his political power. I mean, they believed a lot of things. But rather relevant to this conversation, they believed that the Pope should not be that kind of political overseer and ruler. So guess who the reformers sent their evangelist to? It's not that hard. You could easily get there. They sent their evangelist to all of the European kings and fiats. And ultimately, they offered them a deal. The deal was, you can remain Christian and now be Lutheran. Or you can remain Christian and now be Reformed. And you no longer need to be underneath the Pope and deal with all of that stuff, but you have to claim this theology as your own. So you might not know this, but if you want to do history into the Reformation, there are several battles and skirmishes and fights between Catholic lords and what become Reformed or Protestant lords, because ultimately it was a fight over who would have power over the people. Would it be the Pope or would it be the individual leader? And these reformers were offering a different way to allocate that power. Because it's the 15th century that Gutenberg invents the printing press. And the reformers are one of the chief advocates and users of the printing press. And I, Michael, would love to have a conversation with all of you about the possible implications of that for the church in the 21st century and some of the communication advances that have happened. What are the implications of those in light of our past history? We don't have time for that, though I know we all want to talk about it. No, now here, the thing that the printing press does that radically changes the worldview is it makes it so that Christians believe for the first time in history that the gospel can be read in the local language and should be understood by every person. This is a concept which is, I think, impossible for us to get into our heads. I think we so take that for granted. Let me say something that's going to confuse you. Do you know that the Bible of the Middle Ages are stained glass windows? You realize the reason stained glass windows were invented is so that the normal church attender would understand what the gospel was. Why? They could not read. And if they could read, they didn't have a book. There is no book. What the printing press does is it makes the mass translation and the mass distribution of Bibles possible for the first time in history. I want to be 100% clear. This is 1,500 years of church history before the printing press. So what we struggle to understand, and I'm maybe making my point a little too strongly because I want to try to make sure that we see the dichotomy here. The first 1,500 years of Christian history, evangelism is about, do you get the Lord or the king or the leader on your side? Ultimately, do they profess Christianity? Because if they do, guess what happens? The nation becomes Christian. They build churches with Christian crosses in them. They bring in monks and priests who will teach the people. All evangelism, essentially, is about going into a nation group and trying to convince or trying to lead that leadership into the faith. Post-Reformation, post-printing of the printing press and books and Bible, the reformers suddenly go to families and individuals, and they say, no, your job and responsibility has been, since the first pages of Scripture, the New Testament, has been to be people of faith. And so, it should not surprise you, not only were reformers the first to use the printing press, they were the first to advocate for public education. Why? Because if you had a book, it made no difference if you couldn't read it. Now, this has led to a fascinating change in evangelism across the world. Because Protestants, when they began to send out missionaries across the known world, and by the way, Presbyterians come from that evangelism work. You know that the Reformed tradition did not begin in Ireland where Presbyterianism began. That was a missionary work that came over. And I also like to point out to you that it became popular because the people were angry at the king in England who was making demands against the people in Ireland. So what did they do? They said, well, forget it, king. We've got our own religion. And the king said, well, forget you. I'm starting the Church of England. Hence, we have an Episcopal church down the street, which I love the Episcopals. That's not an insult. But I just want to make this point, is that ultimately there's all of these power plays happening in the midst of evangelism. And it clouds this kind of personal evangelism that we even see recorded in Scripture. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying that the historical record emphasizes the political nature of evangelism until the Reformation. And so when Catholics would go into a community, a good example of this is when we have Christopher Columbus comes to the New World, right? He brought with him priests. We forget this, but everything that was done under the purview of the Pope. So priests come to the New World. When they evangelize the New World, they don't try to translate the Bible into the local language. They don't even try to teach the gospel. They try to get the people to do this kind of religious observances related to Catholicism. When the Reformers begin evangelism efforts in England and throughout Europe, and then ultimately into America and beyond, what's the first thing you think they did? Translate the Bible. What's the first thing that they did? Distribute the Bible. That is a hallmark of all of the evangelistic efforts that will come for the next 500 years when we kick off next week. And I really wanted to emphasize for you all that we have to, as modern Christians, we have to understand, like it or not, that our history is not 500 years old. We like to think that because that's what resonates in our worldview. It resonates for me, I forgot my Bible, it resonates for me far more that this is the core goal of evangelism. Hey, John, have you read John 3:16? Let me read it to you. Let's talk about what it means. That's the modern imagination of John, of evangelism. But for 1,500 years, the church lived in an entirely different frame until the Reformation. And there's both good in it, and there's both great danger in it. Because you see things like the reverse of evangelism that happens throughout the Crusades. You see the kind of actual warfare that happens in South America. You know of the Catholic Church's sanctioning and calling for essentially ethnic cleansing in the name of evangelism. This is part of our history. And once we turn to the 20th century, which becomes a brand new historical movement of evangelism, never before has the world, when it turns 1900, has the world ever seen evangelism with the kind of passion, the kind of organization, the kind of funding that will happen beginning the year 1900. The global missionary movement is something that Christianity has never seen at that scale before. And it builds upon much of this history. It incorporates some of the good lessons. It also falls to some of its worst. And what will ultimately happen is evangelism in the American mind, we're in that, I don't want to steal too much, so I'm going to end here for questions, and then we'll jump into this next week. But here's a teaser for you. In the American mind, that's where evangelism turns from a thing that you participate in, or a thing that happens at the sort of edges of your life, and it becomes a thing that you send checks to, and you call missionaries to, and then you send them to other nations to do. The idea of evangelism then takes on a whole other sort of cultural and historical bent at that stage. I'll pause to say this. I wanted to provide a little bit of a practical. Listen, I tried to cover 1,500 years in a day, so give me a little bit of a break. I want to offer you a little bit of a practical word on this. And I think if I was going to offer a practical way what we might learn from this section of history, I think one thing that we might learn is that neither the Protestants nor the Catholics got it all right. I think they both understood something very true. If you look at the Catholic evangelistic efforts throughout history, they tended to allow for local culture to be part of their expression of the faith. In fact, that's one of the things that at its edges, the reformers complained about. That ultimately, are these people really worshiping Jesus, or are they worshiping Mary? Or are they worshiping that statue or whatever? But you all know Christmas is a reappropriation of a pagan holiday. That was one of the monks encountering people celebrating a very dark and dire pagan holiday and said, you have been worshiping on this day. We're giving you a new feast. It's the feast of the birth of Christ. And then history has a way of turning down. And now it's a thing that Christians believe has been a part of the faith since our inception, when historically it's not. I think there's something good to learn from that. There are different expressions of the faith. Because they're not yours doesn't mean that they're not good or helpful or faithful. We should have a more robust theology than that. On the flip side, the Catholics did, and we have to admit, I think at their best, the reformations of the 1960s and the Catholic Church will admit this. We also have to do better than if your king is Christian, you are Christian. Clearly, there is an individual responsibility taught in the New Testament. Clearly, the understanding and proclamation of the gospel needs to be made so that the person can understand it in their own language, in their own context. All of this matters. And I think that ultimately, at our best, we live somewhere in that tension, allowing people to make the faith their own in their own place, and recognizing also that we make it accessible so that individuals can access that faith, regardless of or not of whether their leadership accepts it. I'll also say this as a final note. I think this is Michael's opinion. You can disagree about this. I think that the history, these 1,500 years of history, should give us some pause when we think of the evangelistic efforts of Christianity, to not think of the evangelistic effort as being nationally done. Now, I would advise us to at least think critically about the idea of the United States sending missionaries. That can become a very dangerous sort of crossover, because governments have different jobs than what Calvin would call the invisible church. That they have many functions, both the keeping of peace, the organizing of the people. They have different values, no matter how closely they're aligned with the values of faith. They have to do things the church can't do, like wage war. So when you put in the hands of the nationalistic structure their job to evangelize, you're putting it in a structure that also has the power to destroy, as one example. The history of that is complicated and convoluted, and I'd love to talk to you about the theology of the reformers related to state, but I do think there is a lesson. Christians do evangelism, and sometimes Christian politicians do evangelism, but they're doing it from the frame of Christian, not politician. That's what I would submit to you, that keeping those boundaries in place, I think we have good historical precedent to see why it helps and why it matters. Because you end up in the year 1500 with reformers saying, hey, Pope, you shouldn't be levying taxes and waging war. That doesn't seem like a thing that Jesus would have called Peter to do. When Christians pair the idea of the expression of faith with a nationalistic identity, that is a very old idea. That is a thing that happened in Europe for thousands of years. And the idea I think that I hear you speaking of is ultimately in the age of enlightenment, the rise of humanism, which we don't have time to talk through these things. But ultimately, you realize the same thing that animates the Reformation and gives the ability for people to proclaim the gospel to individuals is also the thing that gives, for the first time in history, this had never existed before, up to about the Reformation timeframe, atheism. No one was an atheist. That didn't exist. No one believed or had a concept that there was no God. You could believe that God was wrong or that God was not right, but the kind of intellectual sort of belief that deities were not a part of reality came with the humanistic enlightenment, which also gave rise and gave structure to the idea of the reformers and the evangelical sort of efforts. The point I want to make here is very simple. I'm not trying to criticize or I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus. I am trying to say, I think the history of evangelism in the church is always good and bad bundled together. Like, we're going to be humble about it, and we're going to be honest about it. We have, in the sake of doing good things, had implications we didn't intend. That's happened every time. And that remains true throughout this long period of history. The Crusaders, some of them were bloodthirsty, and they were people who could be blessed and be promised a seat in heaven if they went and killed people and they died while doing so. Some of them were truly believing that they were committing a spiritual act called for by God to preserve the Holy Land. They believed that they were going in to do this good work. And that justified the pillaging and the violence and the destruction, which, by the way, the Catholic Church was doing to its own people. So that's the point I just want to make for this section of history. It is largely a political evangelism in this time frame. It is largely a national political kind of effort done by the various branches of the Christian Church. And that brings with it both good and bad. And we would look at that historically. We would have critiques, but I think we would also have things to learn from it. I'll close with this word. I'm grateful for your clarification. I often make these mistakes, and I say things that I'm thinking that you don't understand. My wife would complain about this substantially. I want to be 100% clear. The time frame that we've covered today, talking historically, you realize that representative democratic government does not exist. Right, we're all on the same page about this. That it was monarchs and kings and emperors and military rulers. So I want to be, when I talk about the nationalism, I understand that connects to our current political conversation. All these things, and some people that is an anxious conversation. When we're talking for 1500 years, but the idea of that being ideological does not exist. This exists in the form of royal trees. It exists in the idea of very stratified political power, not vested by the people, vested by right of birth and power. Okay, so that is the context in which American evangelism is happening, which is mind-blowing, I think, to us. And the only reason I linger here, and I know this is hard to get our minds around, I know it is, because we ask, why is this relevant? Is because when we learn that there were people who lived radically different experiences of the faith than us, I think it gives us the ability to pull out of our experience of the faith and to ask some of the larger questions of the further distance, which helps give us clarity. I'll make that case next week. Thanks for being here, everyone.